Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Ian Haney-Lopez, who is a professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley, an incisive voice on white identity. Since the publication of his groundbreaking book, White by Law, he remains at the forefront of conversations about race in modern America. A former professor at Yale and Harvard Law Schools, his latest book just out is Dog Whistle Politics, How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ian Haney-Lopez.
Thanks very much. Glad to be joining you.
And your book is, I think, is one of the most important books that I've read for some time. And I've sort of tried to, over the years, to get my hands around the emerging American plutocracy to the point where I was using the word oligarchy to the point that listeners were complaining about it. But now it appears to be very much in the zeitgeist, I think, and people are starting to – and perhaps we can thank the Occupy movement for the framing the 99% versus the 1%. But what you're bringing to the table here is, in effect, how our politics are serving the ends of both of politicians and of plutocrats who use veiled racist appeals to persuade white voters to support policies that favor the extremely rich while threatening the real interests of middle class and working Americans.
That's right. So I'm trying to explain how we came to a situation in which we have levels of wealth inequality we haven't seen in 100 years. Or another way to ask that question is, how is it that we have been systematically dismantling the advances of New Deal liberalism over the last 50 years? And one important answer is that conservatives have been using race to convince many white voters that the biggest enemy in their life is not concentrated wealth, but is instead government, and in particular the federal government and its social welfare programs.
And I take it that this movement, if you will, started with Ronald Reagan in his 1980 campaign. And I recall that he sort of ran on the ticket that we need to take the handcuffs off the millionaires and put the handcuffs on the welfare queens. And he talked about Cadillac driving welfare queens and strapping young bucks buying T-bone steaks with food stamps.
That's exactly right. And if you think about the story he's telling, there are, you know, the one really striking character, the one that hits most people is this image of a welfare queen or a young buck buying a T-bone steak. It's a stereotypical, really ugly myth of blacks who prefer welfare to work and who refuse to take responsibility, but instead are getting over on the rest of society by ripping off government programs. And I think a lot of people have picked up on that and said, hey, you know, this is sort of ugly racial provocations. But what they don't see is that there are a couple of other characters in the story, and one is the you that Reagan is addressing, ostensibly voters who are white, middle class, hardworking, decent, these taxpayers. And even more importantly, there is a character of government itself. And in Reagan's story, it's government that is reaching into the pockets of these hardworking taxpayers, this implicitly white, law-abiding, decent middle class, and is taking their hard-earned dollars and it's giving it to these layabout, undeserving minorities. And this is key because what Reagan is doing is he's not just impugning minorities, he's tarnishing, indeed darkening, government itself. He's making government seem to be the biggest threat in people's lives. And when people vote for politicians who promise to cut back on government, they think what they're getting is a restriction on government assistance to minorities. But in fact, what they're getting is a rollback of the New Deal. So an end to progressive taxation, massive tax cuts for the rich, an end to regulation of concentrated capital, instead allowing corporations and industry to take over the regulation of themselves once again, an end to social welfare programs, which help everybody achieve or maintain middle-class status.
But what occurs to me, Ian Haney-Lopez, is that the what the Republicans have done, starting with Reagan publicly in terms of their political strategy, what Mitt Romney, the last candidate to run for president, revealed privately in his famous speech to his wealthy backers, where he talked about the 47%, seems to be also along these lines. It really indicates how they think the kind of plutocratic class about the 47% that they're just a bunch of freeloaders.
You know, it's an interesting question how people think. I have no doubt that Reagan himself was a true believer in a Goldwater anti-New Deal. People should succeed or fail on their own, and if people fail, they somehow deserve their fate. I have no doubt that Reagan was a true believer in that sense. What Mitt Romney believes, I don't really know. Was he more in line with his father, who was a moderate Republican? Was he more in line with the way he governed Massachusetts? Was he instead fully in line with the sorts of class-tinted comments that he gave about the disparaging comments that he gave about the 47%? But what's clear is that these are politicians who are responding to two different audiences. On the one hand, they're responding to the audience that's funding their campaign, the major donors, who do want a story in which, since they're rich, since they're powerful, they can tell themselves that they really do deserve to have free reign and that they do deserve to rule in the name of the rest of us. And then the other audience is the mass audience, the voters. And there, these politicians, Reagan and Romney alike, understand that they can't come to the public and say, "I'm here on behalf of the plutocrats. I'm here on behalf of society's sultans, and we think you should shower us with gifts." So instead, they come to voters and say, "I'm here to save you from poor minorities." And that's where we see this sort of racial appeal being harnessed to a project of undoing New Deal liberalism and giving government over again into the hands of the very wealthy.
Well, one of the things that occurs to me, though, Ian Haney-Lopez, is that if the plutocrats and right-wing politicians are keeping racism alive in this way, as a way to galvanize the white minority and to feed into their sense of this atavistic idea the Ozzie and Harriet world that they had that's being taken away from them by these freeloading minorities, and that is how they deal with the sort of demographic time bomb that they're facing. That, to my mind, to some extent, the American left helps that narrative by also keeping racism alive. My sense is that with identity politics, which is in many ways what cripples the left in America.
You know, I'm not sure what to make of the claim that the left is crippled by identity politics. So what do we mean? If we mean that the left pays attention to the role of identity, and in particular not just identity as a source of one's conception of oneself, but identity as placing oneself within the terms of power relationships in society, men over women, white over black, heterosexual over homosexual, I actually think identity politics in that sense is absolutely essential. What we're committed to is a progressive vision of human flourishing in which all people have a chance to become who they want and are not oppressed or restricted in their life choices by these social hierarchies. So I think that that's great. Now, what we mean by identity politics is an assertion that we should be loyal to our groups without question, then I completely agree with you. Of course, there's no sense that we should simply be loyal to whatever group we happen to belong to without question, without interrogating that group social position, I wouldn't characterize the left as being engaged in that sort of identity politics. I think rather it's engaged in a politics that says, pay attention to the way in which society is organized along half a dozen very powerful social hierarchies that places people in different relationships to power and privilege.
Well, I guess because I'm here at Pacifica Radio, I live with that kind of with competing identity politics, and maybe my horizons have been somewhat limited, or at least influenced by that vision. But what I find refreshing about the younger generation, the millennials, is that they are post-racial and post-gender, if you will. And so that means that none of these appeals have any attraction to them.
I wish that were completely the case. I think we can say of the millennials that they understand that they should aspire to not let their worldviews and their social relations be determined by these social hierarchies. And that's an important advance. But it's also the case, for example, if one looks at how whites voted for Mitt Romney, that the youngest cohort of white voters also voted for Romney in a majority rather than a majority of young white voters voting for Obama. So it's not quite the case that the younger generation has fully gotten past race or gotten past gender, but it is the case that I think that more than older generations they aspire to, and they exist in a milieu which is more likely to challenge stereotypical views or latent hostilities.
Well, I certainly don't mean to in any way come across as somebody that doesn't recognize the pain and injustice of racism and who the victims are. I mean, this new movie that's out now, that's up for the Academy Award, 12 Years a Slave. I mean, I noticed that some politicians, you know, in the South were sort of saying, well, you know, how come, you know, African Americans haven't gotten over it? I mean, you know, and to which I can't remember who it was. Maybe it was the Reverend Al Sharpton or somebody replied, well, you know, we were the only group that were brought here and changed. You know, the rest of you, I know what happened. The apologist was saying that other ethnic groups came here to the United States and made it. And therefore, how come African Americans didn't make it? And then, of course, the retort was, "Well, you know, we came in chains." I'm not sure who it was that in both cases I'm quoting here. I'm not doing a particularly good job of, but that is, you know, there's no question. And look what just happened down in Florida with that case. I mean, fortunately, the ruling was not like it was in the Trayvon Martin case. But when you think about that, the attitude of that white man that shot into that car full of teenagers, and the indignation that he's actually being held for murder or lesser charges, indicates to me that the mentality of racism is alive and well.
I absolutely think so. I think that racism has evolved, and it has evolved in ways that we can celebrate a lessening of racism in many domains. I really think that there is something remarkable about having an African-American president who is not only elected but reelected. At the same time, racism still remains pervasive in the sense that these stereotypes are white about blacks, about Latinos, about Muslims now, about Asians, that they're pervasive, that they're widespread, and also in the fundamental sense that our politics continue to be organized around racial appeals. So the Republican Party today is effectively a party that is constituted in terms of appeals to white solidarity. It draws 90% of its support from white voters. Its state elected officials are 98% white. So it's very hard to suggest, or it's unconvincing, it's uncredible to suggest that we are now a post-racial society. And I think that we see eruptions of racism in some dramatic cases, like the Trayvon Martin case, or I think it's the Jordan Davis case in Florida. But even more than in those particular episodes, we really see it in the way in which our politics is organized. And here's a point I really want to emphasize. When we talk about how pervasive racism is in the society, we're not just talking about how this harms minorities. When we think about how race plays out in our politics, we're talking about how race is being used to hurt all of us, of every race. And this has always been the case, that racism has been used as a tool to distract people from other sorts of issues on which they might have common interest, working conditions in the fields or in mines or in industry. It's very much the case today. Racism is being used to convince people that they need to be afraid of poor minorities when, in fact, the power in our society is located in the hands of a plutocracy that increasingly wields that influence not only over the marketplace but over government itself.
Well, what then can the rest of us do to thwart this cynical these cynical politics where the white vote is captured by political candidates who promise to crack down on crime, curb undocumented immigration, protect the heartland against Islamic infiltration, but at the end of the day, it's a bait and switch. What they're really doing is cutting taxes for the rich and giving corporations, free rein and deregulating both industry, environment, and financial markets, at the same time calling for cuts in what little social safety net we have in our somewhat limited social democracy, Social Security and Medicare.
I think we need to do two things simultaneously. We need to reclaim liberalism, and we need to contest racism. Let me expand a little bit. We understand the sorts of policies that help spread wealth to the vast majority of Americans. They're the policies that we developed during the New Deal era. These policies used to be embraced by Democrats and Republicans alike. They include things like progressive taxation, regulation of industry to protect the marketplace, to protect the environment, to protect workers, the creation of routes of upward mobility, including education, including financing for homes so people can build equity, and investment in infrastructure, government investment in infrastructure to lay the groundwork for the next great economic advance. We understand that those are the policies that we need, but we've stopped defending those policies because the right has been successful in demonizing those policies as handouts for minorities. So we need to, A, recommit to a liberal vision of government in service of everybody, and B, start aggressively talking about how racism is hurting all of us. We can expect to encounter more and more race baiting. Liberalism itself has been tarnished, has been darkened, so that the minute you say we need to redouble our efforts with respect to food stamps or welfare or investment in education or in healthcare, we can expect racial attacks. And we need to be prepared to identify them as race baiting, to call them out for what they are and to repudiate them, and to say, we won't let race continue to be used to divide us. And so those two things, reclaim liberalism and also contest this sort of coded racism that passes now for the lingua franca of conservatism.
So you're talking about real solidarity. I mean, and in terms of the left where I am, there is a certain amount of balkanization. How do you basically say that you've got to that we are all being had by the same, is that what you have to say? We're all being had by the same people, that they're trying to divide and conquer us, and that we have much more in common than we have that separates us, and that we've got to prioritize what we have in common over what separates us. But at the same time, they're not mutually exclusive, right? Is that?
No. And I'm not sure that this is real solidarity. In an ideal world, if I were an idealist, I would say we should, as a society, come together and take care of the least among us. That would be idealism. That would be to say, hey, we need to focus on the most injured.
Well, that sounds like the
social repair. That
sounds like the prophet Jesus said all of that.
Exactly. That's idealism. This is something different. This is saying, listen, we need to understand who the common enemy is, and we can all work on the issues that afflict us the most. We can all focus on our own priorities. We don't all need to be self-sacrificing or be saintly in that way. But as we work on our own issues, we need to come to realize that most of us face a common enemy, and that is the power of concentrated wealth and the way in which it's now exerting influence over the marketplace and over government. and that it exerts that influence often through culture war terms, not exclusively through race. We should be clear, this isn't only about race, but race is one of the primary weapons. And so to the extent that we want to contest the power of concentrated wealth over the rest of us, we need to be able to respond to its effort to racially divide us. So this is far short of calling for everybody, for example, to become racial justice activists first and foremost. This is just saying to Americans, listen, if you're worried about your kids, if you're worried about your retirement, if you're trying to understand what happened, that the promise of upward mobility seems to have evaporated, focus on the way in which race and other cultural provocations are being used against you, and be prepared to call out and reject that sort of damaging, divisive racial rhetoric.
Well, Ian Haney-Lopez, I thank you so much for your book, Dog Whistle Politics, How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class.
Absolutely. Looking forward to future conversation.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graeme Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.